The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 552 for Mom. For Sunday, May 10th, 2015.
Folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in questions, tips, cool stuff found. We answer your questions. People have said we're like the click and clack of the Apple world. Does that make us bit and bite? I don't know. You decide. And you, of course, if you decide, you have to decide which is whom, I think. I don't know how that works, but that's how that goes. This episode today, first of all, goes out to all the mothers out there. Hi, Mom. Secondly, but certainly equally as important, well, maybe not quite as important as the moms, because without moms, none of us are here. Secondly, this episode is sponsored in part by Gazelle at gazelle.com. Make sure you choose Mac Geek Gab on your checkout there. But that is the place to both sell and get money for and buy great quality used electronics that you have, your old iPhones and all that stuff. We'll talk more about that during the show. Also, welcoming back a sponsor that we've not seen for a little while here. Happy to have Warby Parker back on board. WarbyParker.com/MGG is where you start to select your five pairs of try-on glasses, all for free. And once you've selected your frames, if you started with that WarbyParker.com/MGG link, you will get free expedited shipping, 3-day shipping on your frame. So we'll talk more about that during the show here in very hot, welcoming, quite welcomed way, Durham, New Hampshire. I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
How goes it today, John F. Braun?
Fantastic.
Lantastic. Like the old thing. I don't know.
Yeah, but Dave, so much new stuff. So, want to offer some tips here?
I do. I want to go through your new stuff, but I have forgotten in the last three episodes to talk about this, and I want to make sure we talk about it. So, I'm just going to stumble all over you and do this. So, there are a couple of special things happening, events happening on the day before Father's Day, actually Saturday, June 20th, in Chicago or just outside of Chicago. It's right near the airport. Okay. There's an event in the afternoon that sort of started this all, called the Midwest Mac Barbecue. And that is, I believe, at MidwestMacBBQ.com. So we will put that in the show notes. That is Barry Falk, a longtime listener of this podcast and many, many others. He was the very first person to sign up for Mac Geek Gab Premium when that opened up, 4 years ago. So there has always been a soft spot in our hearts for Barry. He's a good friend to the show and a good friend to podcasters in general. When he heard Macworld Expo was not happening this year, he was sad, like many of us. And Barry, bless his heart, decided to do something about it. And then he decided he would do it by dedicating his backyard for an afternoon for a barbecue. And everybody is invited, is what he says. So so you can check that out at MidwestMacBBQ.com. Again, we'll put a link in the show notes for that. And it's going to be great. That starts, I think, about 2 in the afternoon, and it'll go probably into the evening and probably move to a local watering hole or something after the fact. There's a hotel we're all staying at. John and I are both going to be there. And it'll be a blast. And yeah, it means that I've got to wake up on Father's Day without my kids, but it's fine. I'll fly home early and I'll be home for the afternoon. So it's all good. So there's that. Anything you want to tell us about that, John? Did I miss anything on that before I move on to phase two?
No, we're good. I look forward to it. Thanks to Barry and the Mac Stock Conference and Expo.
Well, that's the next phase, which we haven't talked about yet.
Sorry.
That's okay. Yep. So then, as John alluded, the afternoon is the party, right? It's the gathering. It's the good stuff. The reason we all get together. But if we are going to be together, well, why not make it a learning experience too, and really kind of tie in both parts of what made Macworld Expo the thing that we all like to go to every year. And again, somebody stepped up. Mike Potter from For Mac Eyes Only podcast has created MacStock 2015, which of course is the inaugural conference for MacStock. It's the first one, and it'll happen in the morning. It won't overlap too much, if at all, with the barbecue. So there's going to be some great speakers there. I am one of them. Mike's going to speak. Chuck Joyner's going to speak. Julie Kuhl is going to speak. Gene McDonald, Guy Searle, a longtime friend of the show. Allison Sheridan, of course, from the Nozilla cast, another long time. Everybody, we're all good friends, right? Tim Robertson, currently of OWC, but also of mymac.com, which he still does. So it's going to be an Eric Erickson, who I actually don't know. So I look forward to both speaking there. I think the speaking slots are pretty short. They're all like, 20 or 30 minute slots, which is great. And so you can find more about that at max.conferenceandexpo.com. And I might even have like a special link I'm supposed to use because I'm a speaker. And if I do, I'll put that in the show notes. But for now, we'll just put the regular one so that you can find out about it and book your travel, if so. Should be a blast. I'm really looking forward to it. And I hope if anybody is able, that you are able to, that you do choose to join us.
Yeah.
Because it should be a blast.
I already put it in there, but you can put it in again.
Oh, sorry. Thanks for doing that, man. Yes. All right. So that is, that's that. That's the business that I keep. We get to the end of the show and I think, oh, dang it. I forgot to mention it. Time's ticking here. So I know if you want to make travel plans, there's still plenty of time to make travel plans, of course. So I'm flying in. I guess you and I are flying in together, John, because we're going to go to an event in New York on Thursday night, and then Friday night we're going to fly in. So there will almost certainly be some level of impromptu or perhaps coordinated, just not yet coordinated, gathering on Friday evening as well. I think there's the Holiday Inn, Garden Inn or something. It's on the barbecue website with the hotel that most of us are staying at. So, there probably will be a pre event of some kind. There's been all kinds of discussion about it. So I'm going to leave that alone for now, but it's something will happen. So if you can come in on Friday and be there early enough, that would be a good thing. All right. That's what I got. So John, you've made some changes in your life.
First, so many changes.
The first was to fix a problem, right? The problem we heard during last week's show.
The first change. So let me go in order here.
Okay.
That they're in my head. Sure. So the first change is that I upgraded my Mac Mini to Yosemite. And I just want to offer a tip here. Yosemite, of course, has been out for quite a while here. But I ran into a little hitch here. So I just wanted to share this very quickly. And I think I know the cause. So, downloaded Yosemite, ran the installer, machine rebooted, got to the screen where you see the progress bar, and then I got about 50% and sat there. And I went online and I'm like, has this happened to anybody else? And yes, it has. So some people said, we'll just wait it out. So, I went out for an hour, did some shopping, cruising around town and stuff like that. I came back, it was still there. And I'm like, all right, power down, reboot. Everything's fine.
My guess for most folks is that you have some sort of when installing Yosemite, and we talked about this 6 months ago when it kind of first surfaced. But my guess is that you had installed some kind of Unix package manager on that computer. Had you? Either Homebrew or Fink, I think you like, or one of those.
I don't believe so, but I'll tell you what I think the cause is.
Okay.
One of my followers suggested this. He's like, hey, was that drive in that machine part of a RAID array? And I'm like, it was. So.
Okay. Yeah. Cause the package manager thing, if there's data in / user local, that will take a long time in certain upgrades and migrations to Yosemite. So it's possible, but you're right. It could have been the RAID thing too. Absolutely.
Yeah, so I tried to wait it out, but I figured an hour with no visible progress was long enough. So I powered down, restarted. Everything's great. Just to make everything, you know, just to clean things up, I downloaded Onyx and did a nice cleanup of, you know, various caches and stuff like that, just to put the system in a nice state. And so far, so good. So I'm all right with that. So
sweet.
So now both machines are running Yosemite. And then the second thing, Dave, so you suggested, because we had some network hiccups, or every now and then I have some network hiccups here, and I don't know if it's the transporter. I seem to think that it is, and one time it certainly was. It was barfing network traffic all over my network, which this caused everybody else to get upset. So you said, hey, you know what? Maybe you should get a better switch. And you, Dave, suggested the TP-Link TL-SG108D. Okay. And I took a look at it, and, you know, it's inexpensive. It's like 20 something bucks. But then, so I went to Amazon, and then you pointed me to a page on Amazon.
Sure.
But then I looked, and it said, well, you know, people that have looked at this, some of them have actually, you know, like me, decided to ignore what Dave Hamilton says and buy something else.
Sure.
And what I saw is that they have a TL-SG108E, which is a smart switch.
Uh-huh.
What does that mean? So normally a regular switch is dumb in that you can't do any sort of configuration. You just plug cables in and it just gives you more ports. And then there's nothing wrong with that. That's fine. But then there's sure. another class of devices called smart switches. And this one was only like $5 more. And I actually ended up getting it from B&H because their shipping was less and they're over here in New York. So it only took like 2 days to get to me. But man, this thing has, for the money, I mean, Dave, this thing has so many features. It's crazy. So, I mean, it shows you the link status of each link, whether it's full duplex or half duplex. Has something called IGMP snooping, which is useful if you're doing multicast traffic. You can do port trunking. You can do monitoring. In that it'll show you, oh, well, okay, this port here, here's how many packets you've sent, you received, here's how many are good and bad. And actually, this is interesting, is that it shows me that I've received about 3,000 bad received packets on port one, which is my cable modem. So that's kind of interesting. So port mirroring, cable testing, that's another thing.
Oh,
and it's
nice.
Smart, and it's smart in that it can actually tell electrically how long your cables are, and it actually right. adapts the power. So this is one of the good things I think about a smart switch or a green switch. I think that's an aspect of a green switch, is that it can vary the power. It's working fine so far.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Loop prevention, and also another feature here. So it has something called loop prevention.
Which model is this? I just want to make sure I get this
right.
It's
the E. So it's the one you recommended, but it has an E at the end.
What's the model number?
SG108E.
108 or
1008?
108E. SG. Let me try this here. So SG108E. Got it. Okay. Thank you. Got it. Perfect. I just wanted to find it so that we could put it in the notes and all that good stuff.
And to wrap up some of the other things that I have, so port-based VLAN, if you're into that sort of thing. Quality of service, so you can actually, at the switch level, prioritize traffic and bandwidth control. It also has something called storm control, which I think may have prevented that problem I had before, mm-hmm. where if it sees excess activity on a certain port, it'll limit it so it doesn't saturate your network. The only downside is the software that lets you do that is Windows. But I'm running it within a Parallels virtual machine on Windows 7, and it runs fine, and it connects no problem. Because actually, because this is a smart switch, it has an IP address.
Oh, isn't that
minor
interesting?
Thing I had, well, you know, it was funny when I looked at it. So, you know, I looked at the bottom of it and it said, oh, yeah, by the way, the address of this device is 192.168.0.1. And here's the username and password. I'm like, oh, that's right. Now, the only thing is I don't run that subnet. I run a 172 subnet. So I had to change the IP address of it to put it in the same subnet.
Or
once I did that,
you could have changed the subnet mask on your Mac instead of it being 255.255.255.0. Mm-hmm. If you changed your Mac to be 255.255.0.0, it would have been able to address that switch because you would have been telling it that anything 192.168. Oh, you might not run 192.168, but if you did, that would be on your local network.
Well, the thing is their software insists that it has to be in the same subnet as,
got it.
As you're on. But yeah.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay. Yeah. Then that makes sense. Got it.
So, so far, I'm very happy with it. Gives you all sorts of statistics here. And I think for the extra money, the thing is, you know, I pulled it out of the box. And the thing is, I plugged it in and didn't run the software and it worked just like a dumb switch.
Yep. Well, it probably, it might have done more than just a dumb switch, right? It might have had that packet storm prevention enabled and all of that stuff, because you don't need to run the software to do that, right?
No, most of that stuff is off by default. So.
Oh, it's off by default. Okay. Got it. Okay.
Yeah. So enable a lot of these features.
I guess that's good. That makes sense.
The only wacky part is that when I ran their software, I noticed that in addition to their software running, once I ran the Windows installer, it was also running Java. And then I started looking at their package, and the only reason I can figure that they're doing this, because at first I thought, well, if it's Java, then why can't you run it on the Mac? But I think they have some legacy. I think TP-Link has some Java components, because when I dug in, it's kind of a mix of DLLs and jar files. So I think, again, that's the only reason I could see to do this. Or they tried to do it in Java and gave up and said, we'll just do it in Windows.
Right.
So. So I would check this out for the money.
It's like $5 more than the unmanaged version, right?
Yeah.
It's not much.
I think they could charge quite a bit more for all the extra stuff it does for you.
That's pretty cool. That's good, man. I'm curious to hear I'm hoping that this solves your problem, or at least helps mitigate your problem. Even if it is with a different device like the transporter or whatever on your network.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Cool. Hey, I want to take a minute and talk about our first sponsor today, which is, as I mentioned, Warby Parker. And that's warbyparker.com/MGG is where you want to go. And I'll tell you why. Warby Parker sells glasses. Now, that's an oversimplification of what they do. They started their mission because they had a couple of problems with the way glasses were being sold to us people that need to wear glasses from time to time, right? Either prescription or not, right? Most of the time, what's happening is you're at your eye doctor's office or some place where there's like lots of fluorescent lights and you're in kind of a pressure situation. If you're at your eye doctor's office, you've got somebody that's basically paid to stand there and tell you how great you look in whatever frames you're trying on just so they can get you to buy and move on. And it's not a pleasant experience. And then when you're finished with that experience, or it could be more pleasant, maybe it is pleasant, but it could be better. And then when you're finished with that experience, you write them a check for like $400 for a pair of glasses that hopefully is going to last you, you know, a couple of years, but you might scratch them. You might do something to them. And so the folks at Warby Parker that started this company said, wait a minute, we can fix this. And so they did two things. First, they slashed the prices, right? You're starting with, you know, polarized sunglasses for $95. You're starting with prescription, regular, you know, clear glasses for the same $95. Even their like, you know, high end, what they call their titanium collection starts at $145, and they're using premium Japanese titanium on these glasses. These are high quality glasses made in the same way that, you know, the far more expensive stuff is. John and I have both had Warby Parker first sponsored this podcast almost exactly 2 years ago. And I still have the pair of glasses that I got from them then. They've held up extremely well. I got another pair of glasses to go through this procedure again. And the procedure is the second part of what makes Warby Parker so good. Instead of standing in a room that has lots of frames and fluorescent lights and, you know, your doctor's staff there kind of pressuring you and doing that, what you do is you go online in your computer comfortably and you can upload a picture of yourself to get an idea, and you start trying out different frames on your face. Now, this isn't the end of the process. This is just how you start. You kind of narrow it down to 5. Now you're going to start at warbyparker.com/MGG. As I mentioned in the pre-show, that's going to get you 3-day shipping for free when you order your final frames. However, this first step is free no matter what. You go narrow it down to 5 frames, and then they're going to send you those frames to your house. They won't put your prescription in them yet because they haven't built these for you. They're sending you try-on frames. You get the try-ons. I ordered mine. They showed up in like 2 days. And then you can try them on at your house. You can, like walk around a little bit, try them in front of a mirror, have your family there, try them in different lighting, wear them for a little while to see how they fit and how the comfort is. And then once you've selected your frame, and you get to have them for 5 days at home, which is, you know, an awesome amount of time. Once you've selected your frames, you send them off, you know, you send the trial pairs back and you tell Warby, okay, now I'm ready to order and I want this frame and here's my prescription. You just, you know, I took a snapshot of my prescription with my iPhone and sent it in and that was that. And then within like 10 days, you know, your glasses ship out and you get them and it's got your prescription in them and you can get, like I said, prescription sunglasses or regular glasses or even non-prescription sunglasses. Warby, you know, they're flexible. Whatever you want to get, that's what they'll do. So you're going to go to warbyparker.com/MGG and then just start picking out glasses and you get five free pairs to try on at home. If you don't like any of those five, send them back. You're not on the hook to order anything. Okay. And you could do it again until you get what you like. warbyparker.com/MGG gets you your five free home try on frames. And then it just makes it easy. And here's the icing on the cake is, as by doing this, you're actually contributing to a charitable cause. For every pair of glasses sold, Warby Parker distributes a pair of glasses to someone in need. So you're buying glasses at a massive discount off of what you would have been paying and what you probably have been paying at your eye doctor. And somebody in need gets a pair too. It's a win-win-win, right? And if you visit warbyparker.com/MGG, like I said, you get expedited shipping. But of course, that's the fourth win because it shows them that we sent you there. And that's good for everybody. It shows them that this kind of advertising works. You're supporting podcasts in general, podcast advertising, and also obviously supporting our show here because it, you know, it shows that it works. And we're glad to have Warby Parker back. Thanks so much to all of you for supporting them and to them for supporting us and you for supporting us and all that good stuff. warbyparker.com/MGG. All right. So I think it's time to go to Daryl here, John. Don't you?
Yeah. And something else new, Dave. How are we going to go to Daryl? We're doing a whole new platform here.
I'm glad you said that because I went to the wrong app. So we've been separately keeping our, we save PDFs of all the questions that we prep for the show, and then we share those in a Dropbox folder is what we've done in the past, and then we put them into our own management systems. For me, that was using Yojimbo, which is great because it syncs amongst all of my computers. And then for John, you were using Preview, and your Preview thing has been, you know, sort of a comedic source over the years because it fails all the time. It's a mismanagement sort of thing. But last week, I decided, well, this is crazy. Why are we not using something where we can actually manage these and share them simultaneously? And so we've jumped to Evernote. And I know we're very late to this party. Evernote was late to the note taking party, right? I've been a note collector and manager for years. And so when Evernote came in, it was like, well, I've already solved this problem. But there's some great things that Evernote does. And so it's not that I was ever against it. It was just that I didn't have a need for it on day one, but I am happy to be testing this out and you can test it out too. We'll put a link in the notes. It's one of those deals where if you use the link, we get, you know, not a kickback, but you know, we get some, like an extension on our Evernote subscription and you get I think an extension on your initial too. So we will put that link in the show notes, but yes, I will go to Evernote and I'm glad you said that because otherwise I would have been hunting around in Yojimbo right now, which of course I can't share with you, which is too bad. And also I can see this on my iPad and my iPhone. And I have actually, for this show, I'm doing PDF annotation inside Evernote on my iPad. So I didn't even have to move the file over to, NoteTaker HD. So it's a simplification of the workflow. Perhaps we will see. Daryl writes, my wife created an iMovie. She took the portions of the movie on her iPhone and then edited it on her MacBook Pro. She wants to be able to show this movie on her iPhone when out of the house. How can she now get this completed movie from her Mac to her iPhone, or even better, in the cloud to stream? So I'm curious what, I'll share my answer, John. I think you've got some thoughts on this, but I'm also curious what all of you think, because there's many ways to do this. And perhaps we'll hear some of them live in the show here from our esteemed guests in the chat room at macgeekab.com/stream. Good morning and happy Mother's Day to any of you to whom that applies. You could put it in there's a couple of ideas that came to mind. One was you could put it in Dropbox, right? And now that's accessible to all your devices. And in Dropbox, you can mark a file as a favorite. And when you do that, it most of the time saves a copy on your iOS device. And those favorites are device independent. So you could have it as a favorite on your iPhone, but not your iPad or whatever. And that way you've got a local copy of it. You're not streaming it from the cloud every time. And that works well. You could manually copy it in iTunes to the videos app on your iPhone. That would be another way of doing this. Those are the first two I'll throw out there. John, do you have any ideas?
Quite a few. So, one platform that I've used for this, Dave, similar to a Dropbox, is Bitkasa.
Okay.
Is one that will actually create a category for, in addition to pictures and stuff. But the client or the iOS client is smart enough to parse out, oh, here's your music, here's your pictures. I'm almost certain it also does movies. And I'm not going to fiddle with it right now. But I'm almost certain that I've used it for that in the past. No, there it is. Well, let's start it up and see what happens.
you can't resist.
Yeah, let's see, mirrored folders. Yeah, I'm sure it has a movies category. So you could look into that. Something else, actually, I mentioned in some prior shows, Dave. Yep. Or one of our recent shows is the that little SanDisk gizmo there, if you don't mind dropping a few dollars.
Yeah, for the external hardware. Yeah, sure. Yep.
The iExpand drive, which lets you shuttle things using a USB port with your Mac, and then has a Lightning port where you plug into your iOS device and then run their software. And I absolutely used it to play a movie. Actually, my test case was a movie that I had ripped, and I pulled it off of my NAS and put it on this drive, plugged it into my iPad, and I was watching a movie on my iPad. Cool stuff.
Nice. I would.
It was interesting that you said, I wasn't sure about this. So you had said, I believe iTunes.
Yeah.
It's funny because I noticed something. I've been researching some questions for people the other day, and they've done something with iTunes. It's kind of a mess, if you ask me. But somebody was asking a question about photos and iTunes. And I was like, well, you can sync your photos using iTunes.
Only if you have iCloud Drive turned off. iCloud photo library turned off. Sorry.
Correct. Yeah. And I don't know if we've mentioned that, but I think it's worth mentioning because I ran into that.
Yep.
Because I saw that because I was like, well, no, and the thing is, Apple's help articles even continue to say this. They're like, oh, you want to sync photos with your iOS device? Well, use iTunes. And it's like, not if iCloud Drive is on.
iCloud Photos. Yeah.
Yeah. And it tells you that. It's like, well, what are you doing here? Basically, if you have your device up in iTunes and you click on photos, it's like, well, why are you even looking at this section? Go away.
Yeah, right.
So that kind of disturbs me that they kind of remove that functionality, be able to directly sync your photos. But the movies, it appears you can still sync your movies from your using iTunes. It's kind of weird. I don't like it.
Yeah. Yeah. Another one that came to mind is a piece of third party software is Infuse from Firecore. That's another favorite of mine, and it does let you just put movies directly into it. VLC will do the same thing. Infuse is a really nice player and does a great job. So we'll put that there too. But iTunes, you're just putting into the videos app there is what you'd be doing on your Mac. But I feel like if you want it in the cloud, Dropbox or Box, is probably easier than trying to. I don't even know how you would do this with Apple's cloud, but so you'd have to use Dropbox or Box, I think, which is too bad. I mean, it's weird, right? I mean, Could you save your iMovie to iCloud from your Mac and then open that same iMovie with iMovie on your iOS device? Of course, the answer is yes. Right?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure.
I don't know about Box, Dave.
Yep.
Because I've been using Box. Or I remember.
Wait, hang on. You're hijacking my question here. I'm curious, right, about how can we add from the cloud, right, in iMovie on iOS? And the answer is yes. We can, if you save it to iCloud Drive, you can pull in your project and play it right inside iMovie and even edit it inside iMovie from there. Yeah. So that would work. And there's, that's your Apple, you know, your Apple centric cloud solution. If you don't want to step outside the Apple box, which, you know, which is understandable, that would be the way to do it. And then you get it right there in iMovie on your iOS device. So you could make edits if you choose, or you could just take the final movie and put it there too. So, okay. All right. Now, what were you saying?
My only problem with Box, if you're thrifty like me and you have the free Box plan,
yeah.
So you're talking Box, the cloud service,
right? Box.
The only thing is if you have their free offering, one of the problems with the free Box offering is that they limit the size of the files that you can sync with.
Oh, okay.
Because I noticed that for some reason I had not used it for a while, and then I realized why I hadn't, because right. I reinstalled it and started syncing, I think, some documents and stuff. And all of a sudden it said, well, I barfed on these and here's why. They're too big.
Sure. And that's going to happen with Dropbox or iCloud Drive, too. I mean, it doesn't limit. It does. But you're probably not going to hit the limit of the file size with a home movie. But I mean, you have storage limits on any of these. So that's something to consider. So, yeah, there you go. There you go. I think those are our answers. I'm looking in the chat room here and seeing YouTube. Actually, that's a great idea, Brian Monroe. Take the final video, put it up to YouTube, and there you go. And you can, you know, when you put stuff on YouTube, you got to create a YouTube account, but that it becomes kind of an extension of your Google account, which you probably already have, and they're free either way. When you put stuff on YouTube, of course, you can put it up and be public with it, but you can also put it up and either be private, where it's only shared with specific people that you that you specify, or you can make it private with the link, which means it's not advertised on YouTube. It doesn't show up in search results. But if someone knows the very, very specific link to that video, which of course you can share, then people could see it. So that there is a, you know, there are degrees of privacy available with YouTube. So, yep. All right. So yeah, that's the way it's, and Brian Monroe says that second option is called unlisted. So it's private and then unlisted. And then just public. So there you go. So thank you. That's great. That's outstanding. What else? Anything else on that one, John? Or time to move on to Finster.
You know, I was wondering if Flickr. Yes, I'm looking right now. Flickr appears to support videos as well. Although I only use it for photos. Yeah.
Oh, there you go.
There's another one. And I think they have the same sort of thing. You can set the who you want to expose things to. My photos, I make them all public because
sure.
I have nothing to hide.
Right. But your, like your photo backups that we talked about in a previous show, those are marked by default as private. And then you can change that. Obviously, once the photo is in there kind of as your backup, you can change it and make it public and part of your Flickr stream. But it when it's just uploaded as a backup, that does not happen. No matter what your defaults are, your photos are not uploaded public when you do it that way. So, which is a good thing. You know, that makes good sense. Sweet.
All right. Now on to Finster.
Gonna take us to Finster. There you go.
Yes. So Finster writes, I was looking at Apple's best practices for Wi-Fi, and it says it is better to only broadcast at 5 gigahertz rather than both G and N. I'm not quite sure about that. But to continue, is it possible to switch the lower band? My Apple TV is third generation and my Roku and Kindle Fire sticks are brand new. So I think what he's asking, or at least my answer, Dave, is you can certainly. So I think the question is, can I turn off? Can I turn off one or the other radios? I think that was the question in there, because
to re-clarify something here. 802.11n is a transmission protocol that works on either 2.4 gigahertz or 5 gigahertz. 802.11g only works, I hope I don't get this wrong, only works on 2.4. 802.11ac only works on 5 gigahertz, but N will work on either band. So the point is, the protocol should not necessarily be related to the band. And what Finster is asking is, can we disable the one of the radios on the thing? And Brian Monroe tells me that I'm wrong, which probably means that you can run 802.11g on 5 gigahertz. He hasn't specified. He says AC works on both 2.4 and 5. Okay. All right. Fair enough. Yeah. But you don't want to get to the point where you're marrying protocols and or confusing protocols and wireless bands. And in this case, he wants to turn off one of them. One of the bands, one of the radios in his device.
Correct. So I don't have the latest AC device, but I have one that has everything but AC in it. So the answer is, while you cannot turn off a radio, and that there is no ability to turn off either the 2.4 or the 5 gigahertz radio in the airport. However, there are a couple of things you can do, and I believe this answered the question. You can limit what protocols are supported on the various radios, and I think that's what's going to help you. So by default, if you take at least this model airport, so I don't have the AC one, but if you take this model airport without AC and you run the airport utility, and then you go to the wireless tab, and then to the wireless options ... button, you're going to see a number of choices here. And one of them is the radio mode. And by default, it's wide open. It's like, oh, well, I'll let you do 802.11a or n on the 5 gigahertz radio and 802.11bg or n on the 2.4 gigahertz radio. And that's by default what it's set up for. Now, if you click on that pull down, you're going to get a couple of options that are going to start limiting and removing some of the choices. And I won't go into all of them, but what I am going to offer is a tip to help you fine tune what protocols you're offering on the various radios. So if you click normally on that menu, you're going to get two additional choices that start limiting things. But then here's a secret, Dave, and I love these secrets. But if you hold down option, instead of getting three options, you're going to get 14. Crazy. You're going to get 14 choices. And I would say, Dave, best practice is that if you know you're not going to need a certain protocol, like, for example, 802.11b is the oldest. And I think that's the, 11 megabits per second on 2.4 gigahertz.
Right.
I would say if you absolutely know for certain that you do not need a protocol like 802.11b, you may want to disable it and not make it a choice. And this menu will let you do that. It can let you select. So, for example, on the 2.4 gigahertz radio, you can say only do G or only do N. Or only do B if you want to.
Though
sure. I don't know why anybody would want to do that, but you certainly can. So I would say if you know, again, all your devices, what their preferred protocol is, then set up your airport to exclude the other ones. Because I think the downside, Dave, is that if you start, the more protocols that you're supporting on either frequency, the potential for the network to operate at less than peak efficiency increases.
Depending on the protocol.
It won't drag it down. So like in the past, some people have said, oh, well, if you allow 802.11b, then that's going to drag everything down to 11 megabits. And it's like, well, no, but it will, I think, affect the efficiency of everything in general.
I want to add something to that conversation. But first with Finster, yeah, you're right. On Apple's routers, you cannot disable either radio. However, if you want to make sure your stuff only connects to your 5 gigahertz radio and that your 2.4 is unused, what you could do is change the SSID. By default, Apple's routers will make both the 5 gigahertz and the 2.4 gigahertz use the same SSID, which is still their recommendation and still ours. I mean, there are scenarios where you'd want it different, and perhaps in Finster's, you would. If you changed the SSID of your 2.4 gigahertz radio to be different from the 5 and only told your devices to connect to that SSID, then you're golden, right? Because you're not going to connect to it. You could even change it to don't use. You might even be able to. I don't have one of those, so I can't test it, John. Maybe you can, but I don't. I know you can change the name. I don't know if you could then say, and don't advertise the 2.4 gigahertz one, which would be a good idea. But that would be a way. It's still going to be broadcasting, that radio will still be on, but you're not going to be connecting to it, which may accomplish what you're looking for here. That's my feeling.
Right.
So
it's a good feeling.
Two other things. Number one, technically, as part of the spec, yes, Brian Monroe, you're right. 802.11ac is supported on 2.4 gigahertz. We've done a little back and forth in the chat room here. Neither one of us can find a single physical instance of a 2.4 gigahertz radio that supports it, though. So I think it's only theoretical. I think in practice, 802.11ac is 5 gigahertz only. And then number two, you were talking about security, or you were talking about speeds, John, and things that would slow your network down. One thing that will definitely slow your network down is if you are running WEP encryption. It is proven to be very, very, very easily hackable with CPUs that exist in our pockets and perhaps even on our wrists these days. Web encryption can be cracked in a matter of minutes, usually single digit. So because of its lack of any kind of security, the standards body dictated that anybody using WEP encryption would be limited to 54 megabits per second. Now, you can't even use WEP on 802.11ac, but you can use it on N, but it won't be any faster than 802.11g because it is artificially limited to be slow if you're using WEP. So you should either use no encryption or use WPA2. And then that gets better. So there you go. That's just a good reminder. Cause I run into people, I go to families' houses and they're like, oh yeah, we have this big long WEP key. I'm like, and you complain that your Wi-Fi range stinks and you get bad speeds, right? They're like, yeah, it's terrible. I'm like, okay, well, here's why. But you know, it's not their fault. They don't know. Nobody comes out and says this other than us, and that's what we're here for.
I don't even see that as I'm looking in the airport utility, so also in the wireless tab there. Yeah. Is the wireless security choice. Oh, okay,
you got to hold down option to do it.
Exactly. Yeah. So the thing is, they don't, and I think that's a good thing. So normally, so their default menu only gives you WPA either personal or enterprise's choices. If you insist, you can hold down option and then it will give you a WEP choice. But yeah, like Dave says, I mean, nobody should be using WEP because it's bad. You might as well not even be using security.
Right. Well, it lulls you into a false sense. And that's why the standards body, I think that was the prime reason they did it. All right. I want to talk about our second sponsor here, John, which is Gazelle, as I mentioned. And Gazelle, it has been a sponsor of Mac Geek Gab for a long time, and for good reason. They provide a service that many of us can simply use over and over and over again. And that is, they will buy back your used electronics and give you cash, and they make it easy. And so I'm going to do my best to talk through this process as fast as possible. But no matter how well I do, and I'm going to do pretty well, it's going to be faster for you to actually do, just do it. You visit gazelle.com. You select what kind of device you have. You'll notice I haven't told you to put your name in yet. You don't. You select what kind of device you have that you want to sell. You answer some questions about it. Like, is it, you know, is it an iPhone or is it an iPad or is it a MacBook? And then, okay, it's an iPhone. Well, was it an AT&T phone? Was it a Verizon phone? What is it, an iPhone 4? Is it an iPhone 5S? Is it a 6? Well, how big is it? Does it have 16 gigs of RAM? Does it have 16 gigs of storage? 32, 64, 128, right? What's the answer? What condition is it in? Good, fair, poor? Answer the question. They give you some guidance. You know, this indicates, you know, fair. This indicates good. This indicates poor. And does it have engraving? Answer all these questions. Then it asks you for your address. And then it shows you a number, right? And it says, here, okay, here's what we'll pay for it. If you like the number, then you put in your address. You put in your name. You put in your address. That's it. Nope. You'll notice you never put in a credit card. You might want to put in your PayPal address, though. Not that they're going to take anything out of the account, but in the end, they can send you your money that way. They can also send you a check. Or if you buy stuff on Amazon, they'll send you an Amazon gift card for 5% more than the number that they previously told you. And then a box appears. You haven't spent any money. You're not going to spend any money as part of this process. It's just not how it works. A box appears. You put your stuff in it. You put the label on it. It's got the label inside. It's got tape inside. You don't need anything. You just put your stuff in. Done. And follow some instructions. You got to make sure that you've turned off Find My iPhone on your phone so that you're not in activation lock land and all of that. And then you ship it back to them. No charge to you. When they get it, they evaluate it. Make sure you sent them what you said you were going to send them. Done. You got your money. Their customer service has been fantastic. We have heard so many great stories from all of you about how much they care about you, their customers. They go out of their way to help people. So you are in good hands. I feel totally confident recommending these folks. Yes, this is a paid spot, but I recommend them separate from that as well. I'm happy to do so. They just do so well. And now you can buy stuff from them. So yes, on the selling side, money never leaves your pocket. It just comes into your pocket. But when you're going to buy something, you're going to spend some money. And that's the thing. You're not going to spend a whole lot because they've got all these great used devices. A lot of them, they kind of sell out the back door in bulk. But the really good ones, they keep and they sell to somebody else that needs it. You want to get a phone that's unlocked and ready to go? You don't want to pay full price? Pay Gazelle's price. Check it out. You got to look at it. And they have a certified guarantee. It goes through a 30-point inspection. And again, same customer service I told you about on the other side. It's Gazelle, right? So you're good to go. You got to check it all out. Gazelle.com. And that's it. It's that simple. But if you started this process when I started this spot 3.75 minutes ago, you'd be finished. I swear to you. It's much faster than it takes for me to explain it. So you got to check it out. Gazelle.com. That's all it takes. On the checkout, by the way, they'll ask you where you heard about it. Mention Mac Geek Gab. And you don't even have to mention. They make it easy, of course. You just choose it from a list. That's it. We're right there. And that lets them know. Same thing. That's it. Gazelle.com. It's that simple. And you get your money. All right, John. What do we got? Let's see. We've got some tips about... Well, we got a couple about photos and one about mail. You want to take us to Thomas there?
Yes. That was great. So this actually caught my attention. I believe I was looking at the Mac Observer Twitter feed, and I saw an article from our own Kelly. And it reminded me that Photos is, Photos is, of course, the new program that comes in Yosemite to handle your photos to replace Aperture and iPhoto. But it's missing some features, and this has gotten some people ready to shake their fists. And I remember that a number of episodes ago, Thomas asked us, hey, by the way, guys, is there any way to do a batch change in photos? And as far as I could tell, the answer is no. Well, that has now changed. And I will direct you to an article from Kelly that found that there's basically a way to, outside of photos, accomplish this task. And I will. And so I sent this off to Thomas, and Thomas appreciated it. So read the article, How to Get Batch Change Back in Photos for Mac.
Perfect. How do you get batch change back, John? So that
well, it goes into detail. I don't want to read it to you here, but basically you're adding something to one of your service menus that then gives you this this ability back.
Okay. Huh. That's cool.
And so the article goes into detail about how to add the service to your system so you can do batch changes. And then it involves some scripting and or Automator, but I'm not going to go into detail.
But we've got the script right there. Yeah, no, I wanted an overview so people knew what they were getting themselves into. That's awesome. That's great.
Yeah. This reminds me too, the other fish shake that a lot of people have is that you cannot edit location data within Photos. And I think at this point you're going to have to rely, I think, on an EXIF editor, EXIF being the extended data that is often embedded in a photo. I think that's the only way you could accomplish this right now.
Okay.
I mean, I get the location because I have a camera right now that has a GPS in it. And when I enable the GPS, it does, you know, put the latitude and longitude within Photos and you can view it. But there's no way to edit that data after the fact.
Got it.
So maybe I'll whip something together, because some people realize, oh gosh, you know, I want to put the location in the photo and my camera didn't do it. And now Photos won't let you do it either. Whereas Aperture did. And I believe also iPhoto would let you do it after the fact. So, that's something. If anybody knows how to accomplish that, in a better way, that'd be great.
Yeah. 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 And of course your iPhone has the ability to, save location data, and you can configure that in, I believe it's in settings, privacy, right? It's always in a weird spot, but in my opinion it's changed, but yeah, settings, privacy, Photos, is it at the bottom of that? Settings, privacy, location services, and then you allow the camera to use your location while using the app. That's one spot. Is it elsewhere too? Is there like a setting to say don't add?
No, you're right. That's the only place. The setting, because typically I disable that because especially if I'm taking photos around the house, because I don't want my fans and my enemies to know my exact location.
I see. Other than, you know, just looking up where John F. Braun in Fairfield, Connecticut, which you say at the beginning of every show.
Yeah, you could do that too.
Right.
Yeah, I was unlisted for a while. So yeah, you can find me and stop by. You know, we can have a little chat, maybe, you know, barbecue or something like that.
Sounds like squirrels. A plan. That's right. You're gonna barbecue squirrels with our fans? Dude, that's a little weird.
there's plenty of them out there. I mean, them's good eating.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, let's go back around to Andrew with another tip. He says, let's see, where is the tip here? I got to get to the tip. Do I have the right tip? Oh, I have the wrong Andrew. Of course. He says, I'll get there. Oh, where am I here? Oh, what have I done? This is the problem.
You're shaking your fist at me getting lost.
I know. Well, it's nice just, work, I got to do it. I think. So he says, there's a delete thing here. I had it. All right. He says, I see why I have a problem with this. Okay. Sorry, folks. I pulled a John F. Braun here. Andrew says, by playing around, I have found a way to delete files from my main library on my MacBook with PhotoStream. If you right click or two finger click on a picture in Photos or Pictures and select delete, it deletes from the photo stream and any other folder and library. If you use the keyboard with command delete, it deletes from the photo stream and any other folder and library. However, if you select a picture or pictures and just use delete on the keyboard, it deletes from photo stream, but not any other folder or library. So again, using delete from the keyboard, only photo stream is what it deletes from. If you use command delete from the keyboard, it deletes from everywhere. And then if you choose the right click menu, the delete there will delete from everywhere. Got it? It was easier to explain than it was to find. But now I know why. I thought I had a reply from of my own in there that I was going to ignore. But in fact, it was Andrew. And lastly, on the tips, I believe, for this episode, Seth has something you want to share for us, John. Maybe you'll do better than me.
Ah, yes. This is a very good one here, because it's something I didn't know.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm not paying attention, but our listeners are. So, this is in regards to mail. One thing that we pointed out here, especially with IMAP mail, is that you want all your IMAP clients, whether they be running on your Mac or your iOS device or even a Windows machine or any computer, but you want the settings to the various major mailboxes to all be the same, because if they're not, you're going to see mysterious things happening, like things disappearing. Now, it could be due to a bug in mail, which I think we've realized may be a problem. But it could also be that one of your machines is doing exactly what it's been told to. For example, here's one of the examples. So your trash mailbox is one where you can set the behavior depending on the platform that you're on. And in my case, actually, what I do, Dave, is now you could set your trash to never empty. But to me, what's the point of the trash unless you empty it? I actually, so let's say that you want to not ever get rid of your trash, or I guess delete is how it may also be classified. Well, Seth noticed something here, which could explain why you're seeing weird things happening with iCloud. And then if you go to the iCloud web interface, the default setting for trash, or the only setting, I believe, is to delete after 30 days.
Right. Yeah.
And as far as I can see, there's no way to change that. So if you want to retain your iCloud trash data,
don't put it in the trash.
Well, don't put it in the trash. Now, I think the one thing is that if you are maintaining... Now, the thing is, people may not know, I'm going to tell you now, is that there is a special interface to Time Machine through mail. So if you're running mail and then you go into Time Machine, you then get a special interface that looks like mail. But, well, it's a cross between mail and Time Machine. And in that case, Dave, I believe you can go back in time. If you made a Time Machine backup at that point in time, you could retrieve it, because I believe it will save the local copy. So all is not lost. If you all of a sudden remember, oh my gosh, there's this thing I trashed 31 days ago and now it's gone and I want to get it back, you should be able to retrieve it with your Time Machine backup, because it does.
That's true.
Save your mailboxes. A good thing to know. I haven't had to do that as of late, and I don't believe they've changed that.
And, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that about iCloud, which is fine. Google Gmail does the same thing. You can set mail to delete on its own and purge the stuff out of the trash mailbox on, you know, on, like you said, the ever after a week or a month or whatever schedule. But on Gmail's end, trash older than 30 days will be purged from the mailbox by the server, which is probably what's happening with iCloud as well. Mail is just a little more in sync with it there. So if you are storing in Gmail, even if you set mail to never delete, which you should, and just let the server take care of it, know that the server is going to delete after 30 days on Gmail. So there you go. A couple of quick questions left, I think, John. I think we can get to we'll get to some of these. I don't know. We'll go to Andrew for sure. And Andrew, that different Andrew, and the one that was throwing me off before, says, every time I open VLC on my Mac after having not used it for a few days, I get this message saying, you are opening VLC for the first time. I know it's expected to get this message when I have downloaded and installed a brand new application or even replaced with an update. It's a security feature. But something is obviously wrong when it comes to VLC, because it asks even when the app has been there for ages and used many times. There are a few other apps I have that do the same thing. Do you have any idea what's going on? Yeah, I do. It sounds like your Launch Services database is corrupt. Launch Services manages lots of things, and this is one of them. And if it can't update itself after you say, yes, it's okay to open, then the data in there will say, oh, yep, first time open, got to ask again. So you can rebuild the launch services database, and there's a couple of ways to do it. The program John mentioned, you mentioned earlier in the show, man, Onyx is absolutely the easiest way to do this in terms of doing it in a graphical interface. But you can do it from the command line too, and it's a single command. It's not that difficult. In fact, everything that Onyx does is doable from the command line. It's just Onyx makes it nice and easy because you don't have to remember terminal commands to do it. There is a great discussion about this issue and what happens and many ways to reset it and clear it up on Stack Exchange, on the Apple Stack Exchange thread there. So we'll put that in the show notes for further reading, but Onyx is your answer. Anytime any of you see this where it's just things are getting weird with app launches and you're getting weird complaints, launch services is most likely the culprit. So we'll put that out there. Don't you think?
I think.
Okay, yeah. Good. Let's see. Let's go a quick question, but it's a good question. You know, I love when there are things that happen when you use computers all the time that you take for granted. And some of them are just little apps that you use that you don't think about, but until it's not there and then you're dead in the water. Like for me, you know, three that jump to mind quickly are text expander and default folder and keyboard maestro, largely keyboard maestro before the multiple clipboards. I am crippled without having a clipboard history, but there's lots of these things that you just take for granted. And some of them are just procedural things, but being asked about these, it is is helpful because it allows us to explain. And Goncalo asks the following. He says, I've started to use Dropbox as a safety measure after my flash drive died and I lost 6 months of work. I have several spreadsheets and Word documents, and I used to keep them on a flash drive so I could access them at work and at home. Since the drive failed and my backup was 6 months old, I started to keep them at my hard drive in the Dropbox folder, and with Dropbox Sync, I can have them at home too. My question is, if my hard drive crashes, do I lose the Dropbox files too? If my Dropbox folder gets corrupted, do I lose everything? Is there a faster way to do this? So if you've been using Dropbox for a long time and you're a geek, you probably wouldn't even think to ask this question, but a new Dropbox user, this is a totally valid question to ask. And there's good news. Goncalo, the way it works is with Dropbox, your files are stored both on your local devices, so in those folders on your Mac and on your work machine, as well as on Dropbox's servers. So with that, even if one of your hard drives crashes, first of all, your data is still on your other hard drive at work. And it's also on Dropbox's server. So even if you only have it on one computer, as long as it's been syncing with Dropbox, the data is there. And it's awesome. It's a great way to restore from a backup from a drive dying. You move to another computer, you log into your Dropbox account, and you can even do that on the web. You don't even have to install the client if you don't want. And immediately begin accessing your files. They're all right there. That is one of the benefits of Dropbox storing your data in their cloud. The downsides are, you know, that you've got to pay for their cloud storage or deal with their free limits. And also they have your data. So if somebody like some, you know, government entity, I always say your data is secure with Dropbox until a subpoena. And as soon as they get that, and they actually not as soon, they'll fight it. But at some level, they, you know, they might have to turn it over. But otherwise, yeah, your data is fine. Now, if your drive gets corrupted such that the data in your Dropbox folder also gets corrupted, those changes will be synced, right? So if you corrupt a file, either because it, you know, something happens to the drive or you just munge it, right? You know, you're in editing and you accidentally hit select all, delete and save, right? Now the data in your Dropbox on all of your computers and on Dropbox's server, that file will now be empty or corrupted. However, Dropbox saves a revision history. For a free account, I believe that history is 5 iterations and a maximum of 30 days, I think. But there is a limit on that. That limit gets a whole lot bigger with paid accounts. So that's something you might want to look into. But yeah, Dropbox still might save you in that situation where you or something that happens on your computer destroys or corrupts that file or deletes it. you can get them back that way too. So there you go. That's the answer. And great question. It's like I said, it's one of those things that's easy to overlook and a great feature, a safety feature of Dropbox. Right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. This is a weird, I've been wanting to talk about this one all week, John. So we will perhaps wrap up with this question from Michael. Okay. I've never heard of this before. So it's going to be one of these weird ones. He says, and he asked some other things, which we answer via email, but I'm going to focus on this one part of it. He said, I'm afraid I'm nearly at the point where I need a new laptop. My trusty late 2008 15-inch MacBook Pro has gotten into a bad habit of not starting up. Nothing. No chime, no beep, nothing. Strangely, and this is the part, folks, if I heat up the laptop with a space heater or in a pinch, a hairdryer, then it starts up and runs like a charm. My path around this behavior is to never shut the machine down, but sometimes even when sleeping, it will drain the battery to the point of not waking up, and then I need to do the heat treatment. I've maxed out the RAM in it, and I've installed a 1 terabyte SSD into the easy access hard drive slot in the battery compartment of this model. He says, I also use a express card slot drive, and he's got clones and all of that stuff. So that's the part that's just weird is, you know, I thought it was a spindle hard drive because some spindle hard drives won't spin up unless they're like, if they're dying, sometimes heating up a spindle hard drive because there's lubrication in there. And if it gets dried out, you know, heating it up can help. But A, you'd hear a startup chime. It just wouldn't find the disk. But B, he's got an SSD in there. So no moving part in that sense. And so it just seems odd. But, we're getting some comments from the chat room. I was curious to your thoughts, John, but I think the folks in the chat room have the magic answer.
As to why this is happening?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, well, it mirrors what my thought would be. So, yeah, it's... So this would be going to physics. The thing is, most things, when you heat them, expand. And when you cool them, contract. So I think what's happening is, well, boiling it down, I think it's a bad either solder joint or flaky connector.
Okay.
And in this case, it's probably the connector that's going from the keyboard to the motherboard in that machine because the power button, last I checked on that class of machine, the power button is actually part of the keyboard assembly. So if you've been in that machine, that may be, you may want to double check and make sure that connection is clean and well secured. If I recall, by default, when you have that connection, it actually has some insulating tape over it to kind of hold the connector down there.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm with the other people here is that, yeah, I mean, it totally makes sense. I mean, the good news is that it sounds reproducible in that when you're at a certain temperature, it's not making a connection, but then when you heat things up, it expands enough to
make
the right connection. And then when you press the power button, it works.
It may be that it's a bad connection. If it's not the entire keyboard, right, it could just be a bad connection in the power button itself, right? And so... heating that up does it, but you don't use the power button at any other time because your computer's on. You open the lid and it wakes up. You don't need the power button. So I'd be curious, actually, if while you're using it, I mean, obviously the computer itself is generating some heat, so this is not an isolating experiment, but I'd be curious if you hit the power button while it's running. Just tap it once. It should bring up the little shutdown dialogue or the restart, shutdown, sleep, or cancel dialogue is what should appear. I'm curious if it would. Yeah, I'm totally with you now. Now I get it. Of course, that's what's happening. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So if you wanted to repair it, I would say replacing the keyboard maybe. But this is an old... I mean, this is the class of machine that I recently...
This is one step
it's
past
2008.
Late.
Oh, I know. Because I had, yeah, that's what I was saying. Yeah. I had an early 2008. So this is the late 2008, which I believe was the first unibody, right?
I would believe that too. He didn't say that specifically, but I'm 99% certain that is correct. I'm with you on that. Yeah. Cause he said it's got the way easy, hard drive access support, which we did not have, right?
But no, we had the way hard.
Most certainly.
Almost impossible.
Well, it's not impossible. Like I said, Lucas and I did it last weekend. I mean, it was a 20-minute thing. Once you've done it, it's like, once you've done it and when you have the iFixit instructions, I can't stress enough how differently I view the concept of opening a laptop now that iFixit's instructions exist, because without those, think about this, right? You know, it used to be, and this is why I swore off opening laptops. You had no idea where to even start. You just start looking at the thing. You're like, well, I see some screws here. I see some screws there. I don't know if I need to unscrew these or if I do, in what order, right? I mean, these iFixit instructions take all the guesswork out of it, and it makes a huge difference, because there's parts like on our old ones, like the early 2008s, you know, you unscrewed all the right things and you flipped it around the right ways. And then finally it was time to take the keyboard off. But, you know, you have to start lifting from the back and then get to the front and pop these clips that take a lot of pressure, more pressure than you would ever feel comfortable just guessing at doing. And then, oh, by the way, don't lift too much because there's that keyboard connector way in the back where you started. I mean, you know, knowing this is way more than half the battle. It's like 90% of the battle. So those iFixit instructions, it's killer. It's killer. You can't live without them. I can't. I won't open laptops without them. Or I don't want to. The last laptop I opened before iFixit existed was for the guy who wrote, I mean, he did a lot of other things, but he wrote Miami Vice, the theme song, right? Jan Hammer. I did some work for him. And he called me up and he's like, oh, Dave, I need the data off my son's dead laptop. And I'm like, okay, man, I'm going to do this because I love you. But here's the deal. I will open it up. I will get the hard drive out, but I will not. This laptop, we are sacrificing everything around the drive, right? If you're okay with that, he's like, I don't care about the laptop. I just want the data off the hard drive. My son needs this stuff. And I thought, okay, fine. So I just dug in and ripped in. And when I found the hard drive, I ripped it out and put the rest of the laptop in the trash. It was like, okay, that's a recycled, you know, I mean, I took care of it mostly responsibly, but there was no effort to maintain my breadcrumbs of a path going in. And then after iFixit came around, then I was like, oh, okay. You know, but it was an iBook or something that I had never been into before. So that was the last one.
Oh yeah. Well, same with this Mini, dude. I would, first off, the Mac Mini, at least the one that I have here, the 2010, and I think it gets worse as they get newer. But this machine was not meant to be worked on by, I'll say that the memory was intended to be replaced by the user, because it's right there when you pop open the when you screw off the bottom. But the hard drive, unless you had those instructions, because it actually involves you moving the motherboard.
Oh, yeah, right.
Moving the motherboard ever so slightly, because they didn't have quite enough clearance for the hard drive to come out unless you pull the motherboard forward. But you don't want to pull it forward too much, because then you're going to disconnect the IR sensor.
Right.
In this class of machine. But I remember reading that and I'm like, oh, man, if I didn't have the instructions, I would have destroyed everything, or at the very least would have disconnected the IR receiver. Not that I really use it on the Mini that much.
Yes. Yeah.
Interesting. They still have it. I wonder if they still have that on the latest Mini.
I don't know. I've never been inside a Mini. Those I hear, you know, not as easy. Hey, before we wrap up today, I just want to very, very quickly. I had my epiphany moment with the Apple Watch this week. And it actually happened during an episode of our Daily Observations podcast. I think it was Thursday's. I believe it was Thursday's episode of the Mac Observer Daily Observations. I'll find the link. I'll put it in the show notes. I'll find the show. But I'll summarize here, too. But it's a great podcast. You should listen to it. Short, like 20 minutes each day. I'm not always on it. Jeff Gamet brings in different members of the staff to talk about different things. But anyway, I had been keeping, you know, so I've been wearing the watch since it showed up. So 2 weeks and 2 days now, because it's Sunday. And there's some things about it that are fine, but you know, I just didn't get the whole, I hadn't bought into the whole use case of it yet. And part of the issue was a lot of the use of it sort of stinks, because third party apps aren't there yet. And we can't really blame the vendors. They, you know, they've only had the watch for 2 weeks at best. Right. So, and there's, you know, a lot of the glances are slow, but my problem was I had left all of these third-party apps just cluttered up on my watch. That, you know, I keep a lot of apps on my iPhone, and so all of those, if they had watch apps, just appeared on my watch. And then, of course, all the glances were there. And I was keeping them even though I wasn't using them, because I have this hope of, well, you know, each of these vendors is probably, some of them anyway, are going to update their watch apps and make them better now that they can really test on the device and see about timing and, you know, how long it takes to do things and what's bad and what's good. And I realized that's exactly the wrong way to do it. The watch should be a very, very, like almost ruthlessly streamlined experience. And so you got to just turn off all the apps that you're not using. Certainly turn off all the glances that you're not going to use, and really, really, like, again, ruthlessly streamline down on what you're doing with the watch. And I did this on Thursday. I still need to do more of it. And all I'll do is I'll just watch the update logs. I don't have my iPhone update apps automatically because I like to see change logs. And that's my way of forcing myself to reminding myself to read change logs. So I do that anyway. And I'll see when somebody says we've updated our watch app, and it's like, okay, I'll go turn that back on and try it again. But it, you know, whereas with my phone, for the most part, I can just leave piles of apps on there. And again, for the most part, they don't just go off and run in the background, Skype, and ruin things. But on the watch, it was definitely not the case. So, yes, there's still some things that Apple will need to, and I'm sure will change with the watch in terms of what they need to really coalesce updates. Especially for glances. When I go into glances, it should just update everything. So, because I get a lot of time where I get to a glance and I get this blurry watch screen while the app is blank, and I get, you know, like 5 to 15 seconds of waiting for the data to come in. And if I have to, my feeling on the watch is if I have to interact with it for more than 5 seconds, I should just go get my phone. So these glances need to be made a lot faster, but they need to do it efficiently so that they're not burning up the battery. But I think they should coalesce the updates. As soon as you open glances, it should just go, boom, we're going to get everything and then be done. So, but you know, they'll get there. They'll figure it out. But now I'm really kind of coming around to it. I'm only using apps that are really, really well done for it. And even though there might be an app that I think, oh, this could be good, but it's not quite there, I just kill it. And now I'm really kind of coming around to the way the watch works. I've got to go to, to Disney World this week for my son's jazz band is actually playing down there on Friday. And so I'm looking forward to wearing the watch while we're moving around in the park and that kind of thing. And I have worn it. I got the sport band, which is really light. And I wore the watch the whole time at my gig on Friday night. And it was cool having it track my heart rate and average heart rate and, you know, and my caloric burn and all that stuff. So there's some, I'm starting to come around to this. We'll see how it goes. I really like the messaging. I've kind of gotten into that, but it takes a little while to just kind of grok the UI. It's not intuitive on day one. You kind of have to get into it a little bit. And so there you go. That's my quick update on the watch. We'll revisit it every now and then.
Yeah, I like how it gave your daughter a new name.
Yeah,
when you messaged me,
it surprisingly it misspelled my daughter's name, even though I have her name in my address book, obviously, and all that. But yeah, I just dictated a thing on my way back. I said, I did drop my daughter off at work, and it got her name wrong and all that. But one thing that was pretty cool, she had a dance recital last night. And so she was backstage. She only had one number that she was in, and there was like, you know, whatever, 50 numbers in the thing. And so she texted me. I was texting her from the watch. I sent her like a thumbs up after her thing so that I wasn't pulling out my phone or trying to, you know, talk into the thing. But I sent her a thumbs up after her number. And she said, thanks. And then she said, how's the ballet? They did a ballet adaptation of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which was awesome. And she wrote me, how's the ballet? Now, I have all my canned responses on the watch, for text messages, which you can set. You can customize those in the watch app. And so I knew I had one in there that said sweet, because sometimes I respond with sweet. So I figured I'll put that in there and I'll go get it. But at the top of the list, before it had my pre-entered canned responses, it saw that she asked me a question. And so there were three responses at the top: good, great, and bad. And I thought, man, that's killer. And so I tapped great. It was just right there. She asked, how is it? And I tapped great and it was done. So this kind of thing, you know, where it's sort of not predictive, but context sensitive. That's where this device can, it really is, you know, it's efficient at communication. So I'll say that. So I'm kind of getting into it. You know, Twitter's app, horrible. Twitterific's watch app, awesome. You know, the Twitter app, it does like two things and you never would want to do either one of them. Whereas the Twitterific app lets you see when people mention you and you can reply and, you know, do different favorite and retweet. And so again, there's just, you know, it really is up to the app developers, both Apple's internal app developers, as well as third parties, to really define what works. But Twitterific is a killer example of what works really well on the watch. You can get the free Twitterific app for the iPhone, but you have to pay to get notifications to make the watch app useful. It's a couple of bucks. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not horrible. So anyway, yeah,
I'd be really impressed if, in addition to those list of choices there, Dave, they added both a thumbs up and the pile of poo emoticons.
Well, I do have a thumbs up. You know, there's the animated emoticons on the watch. I'll send you one so you can see them. But because you can get them on your iPhone, even though you can't send the animated ones, you can see them. So I'll send you one of those so you can see what it looks like.
All right.
There we are. So it's kind of cool. I'm coming around to it. A week ago, I was like, I don't know. But now I'm like, you know, it's interesting. It's interesting. All right. Well, we survived the first show using Evernote. How'd you like it, John?
It didn't crash.
Sweet. You found, we both found that, well, other than when I blew it, but, you know, we found our things better, and it's nice because we just put them in there. And now when I clear through the show notes, I'll delete them and then they're gone for both of us. We don't have to, you know, manage. So, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I do miss wearing my fun, you know, analog watches. I wish I could wear both and not have stuff on both wrists in a weird way, but not currently. Anyway, feedback@macgeekgab.com is the address to which you can send us anything you want, like Alice's restaurant. What?
Yeah, you're right, Dave. I believe you would send an email to feedback@macgeekgab.com.
I did. I said feedback@macgeekgab.com. That's right. Or premium@macgeekgab.com if you are a Mac Geek Gab premium supporter. And if you can, we would love to have you do that. Of course, if you can't, that's totally fine too. We still want you as a listener. That doesn't change even one iota. But check it out if you are able and interested at macgeekgab.com. That'll get you through. And you can check out how to support us and make a decision from there. But we'd certainly would appreciate it. And to all of you who are premium subscribers already, our heartfelt thanks. Thank you very much. It really, really, it helps. I mean, it makes a difference, obviously, financially. But, you know, just the seeing your support there is humbling and inspiring. It really, really does drive us to make the best show we can every single week for you. Any of you, however, can call us at 206-666-GEEK, which is, John,
4335. That's not all.
It's not
there
all.
Is...
Well, you know, I realized, John, that there are all these international iTunes reviews that I
oh,
had...
Oh, yeah. Thanks for that.
That we had completely... that we don't get to see, but I signed up for my podcast review service from Daniel J. Lewis. And he's written this killer engine that lets us see all of these. And so, you know, now we can see these reviews from all over the place. And Andy writes, all the other tech shows are just rehashing the news. This is real tips and help you can use. Freddie writes, with Dave and John's witty combination of humor and fantastically up-to-date and interesting discussion on every aspect of the Mac user's world, this podcast has something for everyone. While they do go in-depth in certain areas, do not feel put off, as they also cover a great many issues that less advanced users may be having. Not only is this podcast enjoyable to listen to, but also very useful if you want to learn more about your Mac or ask the geeks a question. So that's just a sample of some of these. In fact, Stephen Sheridan, which I think it came from an Ireland review, which he might have written when he was over there, or maybe it's a different Stephen Sheridan, writes an excellent podcast covering all things Mac. Dave and John do an absolutely great job of informing listeners about new Mac technology, along with answering listeners' questions on Mac-related topics, and goes on from there. So thank you so much for the reviews. It really, really, it helps us. I mean, it's great to see, obviously. But it really does help us in terms of ranking in iTunes and all that stuff. So we appreciate it. We appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw us up there the other day. If you go to technology and software how to.
Yeah.
We're typically along with our other podcasting friends.
Yeah.
Usually up there somewhere. Yeah,
it's good stuff.
Gives me warm fuzzy.
It does. Yeah, no, we appreciate it. It's a great way to be able to help the show, and it doesn't take you very long. So please, if you've got a spare minute, do that. And we are up. I think we're at 550 reviews or so worldwide. I think US is just over 400 now. I'd love to see US get over 500. And it wouldn't take many of you, you know. I'm just saying, it wouldn't take many. I'd like to thank Michael Johnston, host of the iOS Show podcast and also publisher of GetAppler.com, for converting this show into AAC and adding all those chapters and links and timestamps and all of that for all of you. Thank you, Michael. Also to the folks at Cashfly, CACHEFLY.com, for the bandwidth to get the show from us to you and the hosting on all of their points of presence all over the world. It makes a great difference for getting your downloads to you quickly. Cashfly. And, of course, to our sponsors, great to have Warby Parker back, warbyparker.com/MGG, to get you free expedited shipping, and your 5 free pairs of glasses could be yours by the time you're hearing the next episode of Mac Geek. Just go there now, warbyparker.com/MGG. No obligation to buy, but go try them on. It's fun. It's a fun process. warbyparker.com/MGG. Also, as we mentioned, Gazelle at gazelle.com. Buy or sell. Sell or buy used Macs. And iTunes, iPods, iPhones. Smile at smilesoftware.com, makers of PDF Pen and Text Expander and all that good stuff. Squarespace at squarespace.com/MGG. Build it beautiful with Squarespace. Linda, LYNDA.com/MGG, for 10 free days of their awesome training videos. And of course, iMazing at iMazing.com. Coupon code MGG gets you 20% off of some great iTunes and or iPhone management software. So you got to check out iMazing. All through Backbeat Media. John, you started the show. Why don't you wrap it up with some killer advice?
I started it, Dave, and I'm going to end it. And how I'm going to end it? I'm going to end it by telling everyone, don't get caught.